and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant?
Dare to think out loud.
You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded.
Dare to think out loud.
You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren.
Dare to think out loud.
You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history.
Dare to think out loud.
You have tuned in to the right show.
Dare to think out loud.
Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Just put a note up there that says you can't log into Revolution Radio. See if somebody catches it.
Thing.
Are you there?
Yeah. It says we're joined. I hear nothing.
I hear nothing as well.
Well, Cal, it says we're on. Are you set to go?
I'm ready to go.
All right. Well, folks, welcome, delayed as it may be, to Dare to Think Out Loud here on the 30th day of July in the year of 2021. And today, Cal and I are going to talk about censorship and how censorship has developed in this country. And we know that during the founding era, we had censorship just as much as we have censorship today. And it came about, especially since the Federalists of the founding era owned most of the newspapers. So it was very easy to just not print what the other people had to say, you know, kind of like Facebook does today. If you put up something they don't like, so that's the way it seems to go. Cal, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing good today, Mike. How about yourself?
Well, I'm coming right along. And you say the weather in Arizona is beginning to be a little bit more like normal?
Yeah, it's we're actually starting to see some monsoon action. So we're looking forward to a little bit more rain.
Oh, okay. Well, what are your thoughts? You've done a lot of reading. I know that. And a lot of different study and research. What are your thoughts on censorship in the founding era of America?
Well, it was employed just as it is today to craft a narrative. The powers that be back then, it would have been the newspaper. Today, it's whoever runs these social media giants, pick and choose, so to speak, what narrative is out there for the people to hear. So that instead of allowing the people to hear the full truth and make a decision for themselves, they give them one side of a story or a slanted story or even false information to craft a certain narrative to lead the people down a certain path. That's how I see it.
Well, Cal, I remember reading that after the Constitutional Convention had convened in September of 1787, that the Federalist newspapers published false stories about how George Mason was greeted when he got back to Virginia, and that the people were there and they were ready to tar and feather him because he hadn't signed the Constitution. And all of that was false. And then as they moved along, the Federalist newspapers even claimed that Patrick Henry was had joined the Federalist cause and was now a convert. That was published. There was also letters published or statements published in newspapers which stated that anti-Federalists were all friends of Daniel Shays, because at that time everyone was blaming Shays' Rebellion for people protesting the government. So they tried to link all of the, you know, much the same thing that we see today, just naturally on a smaller scale. And then, of course, Washington, and I give him credit for this, when the Postmaster General, who was a Federalist, started saying, okay, the Federalist papers, which were in opposition to the Constitution, would not be carried on the stagecoaches, which had been the predominant method, and then they would all be carried by dispatch riders instead. And suddenly, all of those papers that were riding by dispatch riders didn't get there for 6 or 8 weeks, or didn't get there at all. And finally, Washington himself stepped in and said, look, this is going too far. And he ordered, basically fired the Postmaster General of the day. So censorship is nothing new. But Cal, why do people want to censor other people?
Well, usually it's because they don't want other opinions or other views out there that might counter their viewpoint or their narrative, their worldview, their sense of reality. So a lot of people use whatever power that they can come up with to silence others.
Oh, so, okay. So if Dr. A says the coronavirus is just absolutely devastating and everybody needs a vaccine, and Dr. B, with equal credentials, but perhaps not an employee of the federal government, says, no, this is all a hoax. This is false. Taking the jab is hazardous to your health. You can see why the government would not want to allow that person to have a voice that others might hear or read. Do you agree?
Oh, I totally agree. Usually if you're doing a censoring, it's because you have something sinister up your sleeve. I mean, the truth isn't afraid of open opinion and debate. The truth will stand on the truth.
Well, Cal, let's take that back to the Constitutional Convention, where these people agreed to keep the proceedings secret and to never discuss what they did for 50 years.
It's a form of censorship.
Now, how in the world can anybody trust someone who decides they're going to draw up laws that you have to live by and then want everything that they did to create these laws to be held secret for 50 years? Is that the way I look at it? They figured that if everybody waited 50 years before they found out what they did, they'd all be dead by then.
Yeah, pretty much. It'll be dead. Well, there were even those that didn't think that this system would last that long, and within 20 years, they'd be going back for another convention to bring back a total monarchy.
Well, so, I also think here along the lines of what Robert Morris said in a letter to Francis Hopkinson, while the amendments were being debated in the first Congress, and of course, Robert Morris had been the financier of the Revolutionary War, and he was also elected a senator. He had been a delegate at the Constitutional Convention, and then he had been elected a senator from Pennsylvania. Well, of course, our good friend Samuel Bryan, the Sentinel, just absolutely excoriated Robert Morris and produced pretty sound evidence that Morris had embezzled the federal government out of millions of dollars while he was the financier, he and his banking buddies, which included, of course, James Wilson, Alexander Hamilton, and several others. But while the debates were going on, Robert Morris, in this letter to Francis Hopkinson, said, if they pass the right amendment, I will hang. What significance do you put to that, Cal?
That would probably be because of the ex post facto laws or amendment or article, clause, whatever you want to call it. That meant that any of that embezzlement that he and his partners had engaged in would now be constitutionally removed from the books. They couldn't do anything about it. Even if you had all the proof in front of you, there's nothing you could do, because that would be, you would have to pass an ex post facto law in order to prosecute those crimes.
Well, so also, Cal, think about, I think it's in Article 3, I could be wrong, but I think it's Article 3 where they mention that all of the debts owed to the United States had to be, all of the debts owed by the United States had to be paid, and didn't mention anything about the debts owed to the United States. They were excluded with the Constitution. Why would any common, sane bookkeeper make a rule that only one side is to profit?
Because they just want to control the people through debt.
Well, I've got to give Jefferson credit. He did bring that up. And one of the things I think most people don't realize, and of course, I spoke to this on some extent yesterday, but a lot of people don't realize that we have had a, you know, just quite an unusual setup in this whole thing. And that was in Washington's administration, once the Constitution had been ratified by the requisite 9 states, ended up being 11 before the first Congress was seated, that Washington appointed only Federalists to his cabinet and to any position in the federal government. So you had to be of his political party to be accepted or to have a job. Then you had, which meant that every federal judge was a Federalist, every member of the Supreme Court was a Federalist, every office held in his administration was held by a Federalist, except for the office of Secretary of State, which was held by Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson stated he was neither Federalist nor anti-Federalist, so we can't count him being something that he said he wasn't. But we also can't say that he was a Federalist. So almost every job that was in that administration, all with the exception of one, was held by a Federalist. And it's kind of remarkable that, well, also the Congress was overwhelmingly Federalist. In the Senate, it was 20-2. In the House, it was 59-11, I believe, of Federalists. So the anti-Federalists were going to get nothing passed. And they were not going to be able to block anything that the Federalists wanted to do. So the Federalist coup that began at the Constitutional Convention was completed in the first and second Congress. Anything that they didn't think they could get ratified, they added once they took office as Federalists. Now, about 1792, Thomas Jefferson begins to see the racket that's going on with the Federalists, And he begins to complain about that in letters to Washington. And of course, he tells Washington, you certainly are not to blame for any of this, which I think is absolutely ridiculous. What's that thing? The buck stops here. But one of the things that was most revealing about Jefferson's letters is that obviously Washington was not running the government. Have you read those letters, Cal?
I've read a couple of them. I read the one where Jefferson was questioning Washington why he's letting Hamilton run the government and why in the heck we could have retired the debt by now. Why are we still in debt? It was. And then Washington forwarded all those questions on to Hamilton, asking Hamilton, well, how do I answer these questions?
Right. Well, who does that tell you was running the government?
Hamilton. And in reading Hamilton's replies, which I've read too, which is, oh my gosh, that will twist your mind in the pretzels, trying to understand Hamilton. But Hamilton is smart enough to figure out that even Washington wasn't asking him these questions. He knew where those questions were coming from. He knew they were coming from Jefferson.
Right.
He knew that those questions had been planted in Washington's head by Jefferson because he knew Washington wasn't capable of coming up with such ideas. Because Hamilton knew how to manipulate Washington.
Well, obviously that is true. And even, the great historian Forrest MacDonald mentions that the easiest way to manipulate George Washington was to do so by flattery.
Which is probably why Jefferson said, well, this wasn't your fault. I mean, he knew it was, but if he would have took an aggressive stance towards him, he might not have gotten as far as he tried to.
Well, I'm
sure Jefferson, in his heart of hearts, probably thought, this is Washington's fault. But if I blame Washington, hey, you screwed this. Washington's ego will get in the way of getting anything accomplished. So Jefferson knew how to appeal to Washington, how to flatter Washington to appeal to Washington's vanity, just like everybody else who was using Washington as a tool to further their agendas.
Right. And as I also mentioned yesterday, James Madison had jumped sides again. And in 1792, he had come over to the Jefferson side and began to criticize Hamilton and the government. I think very possibly, as I've said, James Madison was the Bill Clinton of his era. He could switch sides, with the blowing wind every day. So he, I'm sure he got up every morning and licked his finger and held it in the air to see which way the political wind was blowing before he made any statements that day. And that's just the politician that Madison was, going from the strong Federalist to then opposing the Federalist. And then once he became president, becoming a Federalist again. So quite the difference there.
They call that flip-flopping, don't they? Is that the term?
In today's world, they most certainly do. But back then, I don't know. There was a series of published letters between Madison and Hamilton.
Yeah.
When they first split. And one of them wrote as Pacificus, and the other one wrote as Herodotus, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And those letters were published as they did their political bout in 1792-1793 era. But anyway, Washington knew from these letters from Jefferson, where he called, the old saying, he called Hamilton almost every name in the book. But one of the things that, in one of the answers, Cal, that Hamilton made to Washington, did you notice that Hamilton talked about the newspapers that Jefferson was supporting to attack the administration?
No, I missed that.
Okay.
I read it just at the time.
Yeah. It said Hamilton says that he had brought in a man from France to run a newspaper. And then, of course, they had gotten Benjamin Franklin Bakke, who was Benjamin Franklin's grandson, to open up a newspaper in Philadelphia as well. And of course, the government was in Philadelphia as the headquarters at that time. So then those letters, exchange of letters back and forth of where the accusations, Washington goes back to Jefferson and says, well, you know, Hamilton says that you have hired a newspaper to attack the administration. But anyway, jumping forward from that a bit, we go into the Adams administration. And of course, Jefferson is vice president. Now, we have to admit, or we have to at least state for the record, that Jefferson resigned as Secretary of State at the end of 1793 because he was just absolutely fed up with what Hamilton was doing. The inflation rate was near 70%, and all of the legislators that Hamilton was buying off with banking money and to get to vote his way. And Hamilton was even proposing laws in Congress as a Secretary of Treasury. So we had that going on at the same time. But then Adams is elected president. Jefferson runs against him. Jefferson is vice president because he got the second most votes, which was the way that it worked back then. So that happens. And then in 1798, because many believed in the Anti-Federalist side, or the Democratic Republicans, as Jefferson called his people, they believed that Adams was about to initiate a war with France to accommodate the bankers in England. And the bankers operating, of course, through Hamilton. So there was that issue that was going on. So then Adams becomes very much upset about it, and his wife was involved in this. If you read her letters, Abigail Adams was encouraging him to get Congress to pass a law which made criticism of the government a crime punishable by a heavy fine, $2,000 in those days, which was one heck of a lot of money, and also you could be served time in prison. So, Cal, what are your thoughts about the Sedition Act of 1798?
Well, the Sedition Act is just the logical conclusion of the arrogance of the Federalists. And they created the Constitution in secrecy and through fraud, so it was a lie. So in order to perpetuate the lie, they had to silence anybody that had any criticism, and they had all the levers of power of the federal government to do so. So they passed the Sedition Act, where you couldn't criticize the government, the president, but you could criticize the vice president because, well, that was Jefferson. You can criticize him.
Well, and the legislation was written to end at the end of the Adams administration, whenever that would occur. Of course, this prompted Jefferson and Madison to write the Kentucky and the Virginia resolutions, which are, you know, interesting to read. And, you know, I really like what Jefferson said in the Kentucky resolution. And those resolutions fostered the first known presentation of the theory of nullification. So what did you read into that, Cal?
No, that's where the idea of state nullification comes from, is from the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. Especially from Jefferson saying, if it's not in the Constitution, it can't be a law, and therefore it's null and void.
Well, Cal, as I mentioned to you before we came on the air, I was reading a group of letters that took place between Abigail Adams and Thomas Jefferson. And these letters, like I've said so many times, people, the history of America, the truth of the history of America is to be found in these letters. Because everything else is propaganda, because newspapers were going to print what they wanted to, And today, historians rely on those newspapers more than they do the letters between the founders. And there are literally thousands upon thousands of letters. I mean, there's 1,400 letters between Washington and Jefferson. And I don't know how anyone can believe that they know about the history of this country without reading those letters and reading those letters more than once. And there were thousands of letters between Jefferson and James Monroe, which are very enlightening. But as I mentioned to you earlier, two of the most interesting exchanges that I have found was the exchange between Abigail Adams and Jefferson while Jefferson was president. These are some fantastic letters. And then to also look at after and a little bit, well, Jefferson was still president, the letters that took place and were exchanged between Mercy Otis Warren and John Adams. Now, here's the classics, and the people who want to talk about women in government, if you don't know about those letters, if you haven't read those series of letters between those with those two women, both of whom were exceptionally intelligent. I mean, all you have to do is read what they said. But in one of those letters, and Cal, I don't know if you have it in front of you, if you have access to it, could you find and read the First Amendment for me?
The First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances.
Okay. Cal, what is your interpretation of that?
That Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of the speech or the press.
Okay, it says Congress can't do that, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Well, let me read you an excerpt of a letter from...
Either.
Oh. Are you there, Cal? I think I got bumped off.
Yeah, I lost you for a second. You were going to read a letter from, and then you dropped.
Okay, here was a extract, or, you know, a piece of the letter from excerpt. There, that's the word I was looking for, of a letter between Thomas Jefferson and Abigail Adams. And in it, he says this. Nor does the opinion of the unconstitutionality and consequent nullity of the law remove all restraint from the overwhelming torrent of slander, which is confounding all vice and virtue, all truth and falsehood in the United States. The power to do that is fully possessed by the several state legislatures. It was reserved to them and was denied to the general government by the Constitution according to our Constitution of our construction of it. What he says in this.
He dropped off again.
Wow. It's getting weird, Cal.
Mike, you dropped off. Say that again.
I've said that it was amazing to me, and I don't know why I keep dropping off here. But it was amazing to me that in this letter, Jefferson tells Abigail Adams, while Congress does not have a right to prevent or to repress, the states do. Now, what are your thoughts on that?
The states have a right to suppress the people's speech?
Yes. Have a right to suppress the press. Jefferson states that in his letter to Abigail Adams.
Well, what if the state constitution says you can't?
Well,
all of the state constitutions say that, don't they? That the government can't suppress speech or the press or religion.
Right, but here's my point, Cal. How many states had constitutions then?
At the time of this writing? When did he write
it? Yeah, 1804.
Well, every state had a constitution by then. For every state was a state. Didn't they have to have a 1804, you would have had Kentucky would have been in. Was Florida a state by then?
No.
I'm trying to think of the state. Kentucky, they would have had to have had a constitution in order to be admitted to the Union, I thought. That's my assumption. So the
that's just a question. I don't have the answer to that question, but here was my thought, was where is the evidence? We know that Virginia had one. We know that Massachusetts had one, and we know that Pennsylvania had one. But do we know that all these states had a constitution at that time?
I'd have to research that. I've always taken it for granted that they all did, because that was one of the things that all the states did while they were under the Articles of Confederation. They already had their state constitutions.
Well, I thought that as well, but I guess that's a subject that you and I both will have to research.
Just plug in what the constitutions are of those states and see when they were first ratified. Yeah. It's not that, it just takes a few minutes, but yeah.
I don't think people realize and understand how vitriolic and how attacking the press was during from the end of Adams' administration, maybe the beginning, in the middle of the Adams administration, to the end of the Adams administration. I mean, to the end of the Jefferson administration, for sure. They were, and probably one of the people who came under the most terrible attacks, I mean, just open slander, was Aaron Burr. Because Aaron Burr found himself in a very unusual position. The election of 1800 was tied and voted on in the House of Representatives, I believe, 35 or 36 times. Do you remember that, Cal?
Yeah, some 30-odd times, yes.
Okay, so finally a deal was struck. Although Jefferson disavowed any knowledge of that deal. But what I had read was that one delegate from one of the states that only had one delegate went to Jefferson and told Jefferson, hey, and maybe he went through a third party. We don't know. But according to his word is that he sent word to Jefferson that if he would appoint one of his friends, one of the guy's friends who was asking Jefferson for the deal, is that if he would appoint one of his friends to a high political office, and the office is named in the letters or in the transcript that I read, that he would just not vote in the next time that the vote was taken for President of the United States. And that would, of course, throw it to Jefferson. Well, Jefferson says in his writings that never happened. Of course, we don't know. But he said it never happened. But anyway, the election goes to Jefferson, with Aaron Burr being the vice president. Well, Aaron Burr had turned on the Federalist. He's from New York. He had turned on the Northern Federalist and lent his support in the New York legislature, and in a couple of other states. He had spoken to the Pennsylvania legislature to promote Jefferson. And the letters that went back and forth during this frame are most interesting, especially the ones that concerned Aaron Burr. Because Burr was willing to let Jefferson be president, although there are stories that he tried to pull a trick like allegedly Jefferson did. But it's very interesting because right after the election, Jefferson pulled all support for his vice president. And he started promoting James Adams. Now, here was Aaron Burr stuck on the horns of a dilemma. The Federalists in the North, especially New York, went after Aaron Burr with both barrels blazing. And Jefferson never supported or defended him, because Jefferson, at least this is what I have read, is that Jefferson believed, and he wanted James Madison to be his successor, because they were very close and had been for quite some time. And therefore, he felt like that he could ruin or at least lessen Aaron Burr's chances of being elected president after him by simply not supporting him and letting the press just rip him apart, which the press did. I mean, he was accused back then of being a homosexual. He was accused of all kinds of things, and Burr was pretty well destroyed. And most people are unaware that Alexander Hamilton was behind a lot of those stories. And Aaron Burr gave him three chances to retract those stories, and Hamilton didn't. And therefore, we had the duel on the plains of Weehawken. And the circumstances around that are just absolutely astounding. I mean, it would make one hell of a movie. Aaron Burr was indicted for murder by the state of New York for the duel of when, as vice president, he was indicted by the state of New York for murder. Now, when has that ever happened in history? But being a very adept lawyer himself, Aaron Burr made the statement to the people of New York, well, you know, you can't issue a warrant for me on the charge of murder because the duel took place in New Jersey. So it would be up to New Jersey to charge me with a crime, which New Jersey didn't do. So it's very interesting the way that the press went after both Jefferson and Burr during this time frame. And there were lots of lawsuits around this, I promise you. And some very telling lawsuits. And that's where we get into the theory of, stifling your enemies, not allowing them to speak or to prevent their speech from coming forward. And again, they were doing it through so many of these newspapers. Were you familiar with any of that, Cal?
Vaguely familiar. The question I have is, you say there were lawsuits. What were the results of these lawsuits? Because I'm keeping in the back of my mind that, you know, if you bring a lawsuit, you're going to probably appear in a federal court. And the federal court's already dominated by the Federalists. So what became of those lawsuits? That's my question.
Well, let's drop back a little bit and let's look at one of the lawsuits against a member of Congress, Matthew Lyon, under the Sedition Act. Now, I believe this was the stage that set it all into motion. The Sedition Act, when they said you cannot criticize the government. Well, Matthew Lyon was a member of Congress, and he wrote an editorial in a newspaper critical of John Adams, and he was arrested and tried for under the Sedition Act, a sitting member of Congress, for criticizing the government. Well, they'd all be in jail now. And the people who support Trump would love it. But they would all be in jail for criticizing the government. But Matthew Lyon went to court, and again, one of the strongest members of the Supreme Court at that time, and probably one of the most eloquent, was Samuel Chase. And he, as sitting on the bench, told the jury in the Matthew Lyon's case, it matters not whether Mr. Lyon's comments were true or false, because that's what he based his defense on. Everything I said was true. How can it be slander? How can it be sedition if those statements were true? But Chase, in charging the jury, and it's all on record in the National Archives, people, Chase says to the jury, it does not matter if it's true or false. It only matters that he did it. And he has admitted in court, open court, that he wrote this article in the newspaper that was critical of John Adams and the administration. So the court found him guilty. And Matthew Lyon, as a member of Congress, was sentenced to prison and fined a substantial amount of money. And again, here's a trivia for you. Matthew Lyon was the only member of Congress ever to be reelected while serving a sentence in prison. So that's one of the first trials, and there were others. There was a Callender, C-A-L-L-E-N-D-A-R. He was charged in the Alien and Sedition Act. He also was convicted, but he changed teams under the Jefferson administration. So, what are your thoughts about the different trials?
Well, okay, that Samuel Chase, that's the same Samuel Chase that later the Jefferson administration tried to have impeached?
Yes, exactly.
But failed to do so because, well, he was impeached, but when it went to trial in the Senate, because the Senate was controlled by the buddies of the Federalists, was controlled by the Federalists, and Samuel Chase was a Federalist, obviously he wasn't convicted. And that's when Jefferson says that this impeachment thing in the Constitution is nothing but a scarecrow. Am I correct on that?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. And one of the things here, Jefferson is sitting as president. Now, we all witnessed for 4 years the press's unbridled attacks on Donald Trump. Whether you like him or don't like him, that is a fact. They went after him with both barrels again. I mean, it was a daily occurrence. But stop and think about this editorial, which appeared during Jefferson's administration. And here's what it said. It says, I'm trying to find the paper here that was, and I don't see it right in front of me. I have the quote, which I set ahead here. And that is, and I quote, Mr. Jefferson has for years past, while his wife was living and does now since she is dead, keep a woolly-headed concubine by the name of Sally, that by her he has had several children, and that one by the name of Tom has since his father's election taken upon himself many heirs of importance and boasted his extraction from a president, unquote. That's pretty stiff, isn't it, Cal?
Yeah, especially back then, considering what the norms were.
So here was, while he was president, Jefferson was accused then of being, having an open affair with Sally Hemings publicly. And as the saying goes, other extremists, oh, I love that word, Federalist papers were printing the same stories. Publicly, Jefferson always maintained a philosopher's stance toward the abuse he was getting. In 1803, he wrote to a European friend, and I quote, "It is so difficult to draw a line of separation between the abuse and the wholesome use of the press that as yet we have found it better to trust the public judgment rather than the magistrate, with the discrimination between the truth and falsehood," unquote. So I think that's a very relevant quote by Jefferson in the fact that we should let the public themselves decide what is and what is not true. And that at no time should we censoring people from what they say. Let the people judge. A person who censors other people says to themselves, I have the moral authority to stop you from saying whatever you want to say. And we see that in Facebook. We see it on social media all the time.
We're saying that I have the moral authority to allow you to hear what I think you should be able to hear.
Right. I am only going to allow you to say what I agree with.
Yeah. But now, in the truth of making the decision requires the full truth, both sides of the story. So tying that back to Samuel Chase. Now, Samuel Chase, he told the jury that they couldn't judge on the law, just on the fact. And one of the great palladiums of liberty is that you can have a jury of your peers that can decide on law and on fact. So Samuel Chase was, in essence, through saying that you can't judge on the law, censoring, now this is the government, censoring the jury. And if you censor the jury, you have censored a palladium on liberty. And that's why censorship is antithetical to liberty. Did I say that okay?
Yeah, that's a very valid point and a good point, Cal. But stop and think about it. Here, we're having these trials just a little over 10 years into the history of this government under the Constitution. And yet today we have a plethora of constitutional attorneys and other various people telling us how wonderful that Constitution is. Well, it didn't prohibit this kind of activity from the very beginning. So how can we expect it to prohibit the same thing now?
It not only didn't prohibit, it enabled.
Yes.
The Constitution is an enabling, it enables tyranny. It constitutionalizes tyranny, basically. So, yeah, I don't understand how anybody can support the Constitution, because you're supporting tyranny. A equals A.
Well, during this time frame, Thomas Jefferson wrote to his various leaders of the state, various states. He wrote to them and he said, the press ought to be restored to its credibility if possible. And I have therefore long thought that a few prosecutions of the most prominent offenders would have a wholesome effect. Not a general prosecution, for that would look like persecution, but a selected one, unquote. For the already infuriated Jeffersonians in states where Federalists were most impudent, this was what they had been waiting for. Joseph Denny, the arch Federalist editor of the Philadelphia Port Folic, was promptly charged with seditious libel against the state and the United States. In New York, the selected victim was Harry Croswell. So here we have, and I know Jefferson is kind of he was one of my heroes for so long, but here we have Jefferson and his administration going after his critics, yet he opposed the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. And do you find that in any way hypocritical, Cal?
In some aspects, yeah, I do. But part of this so-called freedom of the press is actually liberty of the press or liberty of expression or liberty of speech involves responsibility. And you throw in this word libel, which means what you say needs to be true and accurate. And if it's slanderous and if it's harmfully slanderous, then you're liable. For, in other words, you're responsible for your words. So if you lie about somebody, and if Jefferson's only method of proving that this is a lie, it's unfortunately through the courts, instead of just printing a separate opinion piece. I don't know why that couldn't have been done, unless that wouldn't have been printed. So yeah, I can see that it, in a lot of ways, it is hypocritical to the Alien and Sedition Act to then turn around and liably charge a newspaper editor. Somewhere there has to be responsibility. That's part of liberty. And it's a much difficult position for a president to be in, because he's a public figure, so he's kind of has to take those arrows more than anybody else has to.
My question, Cal, would be, who determines what's responsible and what's not?
Well, that's where you have a trial by jury, a tribunal. You know, I mean, let's present it all up in front of the people and let the people decide. Once again, we're back to put all the proof out there, put all the truth out there, and let the people decide. Hopefully the people have the intellectual honesty to decide truthfully and not just follow their party or emotional factions.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, Cal, if we followed the dictates that Samuel Chase gave to the jury in the Matthew Lyon trial, if we follow the dictates, we're following the dictates of that today, how many members of the press, especially CNN and PMS, NBC, and even Fox News at some point, if we followed that address back then, how many people in the media today would be in prison?
Probably a lot. I mean, it's one to report false news. It's another to report news and leave certain key aspects out of it. You know, those are two different animals. Like if you can be, and then there's leaving stuff out or accusing people of something that actually harms another. You know, I mean, you're free to do whatever you want as long as you don't harm someone else or infringe on someone else's rights. But that moment you cross that line, now you're liable. Now you're responsible. And that's just part of liberty. And it's finding that balance and that fine line. And that's the struggle that society has to go through all the time. Is finding, yeah, is finding that line. Where does it cross the line of just fake news to liable?
Well, here is something I found interesting, and I'm going to quote from this piece way back when. It says, the burden of the federal song is that Mr. Jefferson paid Callender for writing against the late administration. This is wholly false. The charge is explicitly this. Now, this is in the court proceedings. Jefferson paid Callender for calling Washington a traitor, a robber, and a perjurer, for calling Adams a hoary-headed incendiary, and for most grossly slandering the private characters of men who, he well knew, were virtuous. These charges, not a Democratic editor has yet dared or ever will dare to meet in an open, manly discussion. The tone of the trial was set from the very first defense motion. Croswell's defense demanded copies of indictments before entering a plea. The Attorney General objected and was sustained by the all-Republican bench, and Croswell pleaded not guilty. In his WASP, which was the name of the paper he published, memoir, Croswell says that the Jefferson Callender passage, which was to become the heart of the case, had actually been written by Thomas Grosvenor, but he declined to implicate this young man and took his chances before the court. This required a great deal of courage. A sojourn in the Crude County Jail was no laughing matter in 1803. The defense then requested a postponement until the next session of the circuit court. They argued that on an issue as legally complex as the law of libel, a state Supreme Court justice should sit in as judge. The Attorney General objected, but he was promptly upheld. Jefferson's administration was a circus in a lot of ways. He was in the unenviable position of being the first non-Federalist elected as president, and all of the Federalist forces that had been there under Washington and Adams went after him full bore. Now, when you go into those letters we talked about before between Adams, Abigail Adams and Jefferson, she was upset at Jefferson because he did away with some of the appointees that Adams had made as last-minute appointees to the government. And Jefferson was up. Ah, there we went again. I don't know what's causing that. But anyway, Abigail Adams was upset that Jefferson was upset and had written to Abigail Adams that he was upset that just before, and one especially that he mentioned, was the appointment of John Marshall to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Jefferson was very upset at that because he and Marshall were cousins, but they were big political rivals, even way back in Virginia. So Jefferson told Abigail Adams, "I felt like that was a direct attack on me to put one of my most hated opponents in as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court." Your thoughts on that, Cal?
Jefferson fully expected he was going to be able to appoint the Chief Justice, you know, at least try to take some bite out of the juggernaut of the Federalists. And Adams, you know, did a last minute 12th hour, you know, 11th hour appointment of John Marshall and foiled that plan. And yeah, that did upset Jefferson.
Well, there's the music. Be back on the other side, folks, with Dare to Think Out Loud.
Unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch The Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's The Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
If you think for one second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back! You can torture us and bomb us, fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us!
Good evening. Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well, welcome back, folks, to Dare to Think Out Loud here on Friday, the 30th day of July in the year of 2021. And my friend Cal Robbins and I are discussing censorship and censorship in the history of our country. And what are the purposes of censorship? And what are the defenses against censorship? And when does censorship become libel? Those, or incendiary, I guess, would be another phrase. Cal, what are your thoughts, buddy?
I just want to start, you know, censorship is one of my pet peeves. I have never blocked anyone on Facebook. I've never cut anyone off. I've been made administrator on a bunch of different group sites, and I keep getting notices to, you know, to, is this approved or not? I don't even read the notice. I just pass it on. If somebody has an opinion, you're entitled to it in my viewpoint. And if I disagree with it, I'll take you on in the arena of ideas. I don't, and look for truth. I don't need censorship to silence things that I disagree with. Just reason and logic, you know. That's
so. Are you saying, Cal, that you believe that internet trolls have a voice?
Yeah. I mean, I have the ability to scroll past a troll. I have the ability to ignore the troll. You know, I mean, as long as they're not actually infringing upon my rights, I suppose they can say whatever they want and other people can agree with them or disagree with them or ignore them as well. It comes down to, you know, the individual's liberty to choose and not have someone else choose for them. So, yeah, as annoying as internet trolls are, oh, well. That's just part of the, you know, that's part of the internet. That's part of being able to have all this information out there. There's good with bad in everything, but letting the government decide for me what I think is good or bad is something I don't agree with.
Okay, great position, Cal. I want to read you, and I get into some of these things. But I want to read you something and see if you can tell me who this came from. And it says, friends and fellow citizens, at this momentous crisis when Congress, in compliance with the earnest wishes of a great part of the citizens of the United States, are pretending to revise and amend the new Constitution of Government, every patriotic citizen is loudly called upon to exert all the ability of and influence to obtain the requisite amendments, for upon the present decision will depend the complexion of the general government. Liberty or despotism will be the consequence. This person feels it peculiarly incumbent on him to step forward again on this great occasion, as he was the first person who apprised the public of the defects and dangers of the new Constitution, and was greatly, if not wholly, instrumental in occasioning that enlightened, virtuous, and formidable opposition to the implicit and unqualified establishment of this government, which nothing could have rendered ineffectual but the magical influence of the name of Washington, which diverted the attention of the people from the construction of the new Constitution to a contemplation of his illustrious virtues, and induced them to place an entire dependence in his magnanimous conduct and upright intentions as first magistrate for the security of their dearest privileges and the attainment of their every wish, not considering that to effect these desirable purposes, a proper form of government is essentially necessary to cooperate with even the good intentions of such a magistrate. Unquote. Who was that, Cal?
It sounds like Sentinel.
Ha! Good job. And that is Sentinel number 25.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
And I thought one of his first essays, but okay.
This is when he began 25 through, let me see, what 25 through 40 are in opposition to the Bill of Rights, to so the amendments.
But that's one of those five or six you have.
Right. I have six of them at the present time.
Okay. Yeah. Which you haven't finished transcribing yet.
No. As a matter of fact, these were first published. I mean, last published in 1788. What I have is copies of those published in his longhand, and it is it takes a while to translate these, I promise you, and then to put them onto paper, which I will be sending out to my group.
Yeah, no, I fully understand the expense in labor and time it takes to do something like that, and I feel, you know, I appreciate your efforts and you doing that.
I was pretty anxious
for these next six essays from Sentinel.
Well, I was amazed that I was able to find them.
Yeah, I am.
Because they did not want any of these, you know, why wouldn't someone have republished something this important from 1788 or 89?
Because it would be counter to the narrative. It would not fit the narrative. It would be counter to the myth that everybody believes about the Constitution. You can't have, you know, there's all kinds of myths surrounding the Constitution, and you can't have source documents proving that what people think about the Constitution isn't true. But if you go to the source documents, you'll find out that pretty much everything you were taught in American history is a myth. It's folklore.
Isn't that a form of censorship?
Yes, it is. That's driving the narrative. Yes, it's a form of censorship. And look at the mess of the mess everybody's in because of it. I mean, people out there have that sense of liberty. I mean, you're born with a sense of your rightful liberty and of justice. And you could feel that everything's wrong, but no one can put their finger on it. Well, it's because you're not accepting the full truth. Once you accept the full truth, well, the truth will set you free. It'll become clear. I mean, to me or Mike, why things are the way they are right now, it makes sense if you understand that that's why this government is created the way it is. This is the natural progression of what this government is to become. In fact, it's beyond the wildest dreams of even Hamilton in my book. But this is what they intended. You are living what the founders envisioned. Well, not the founders, the framers envisioned. You're living the Federalist dream, people.
Well, I certainly can't argue against that. But just for fun and games here, let me read you another paragraph from this Sentinel. He said, it is very flattering circumstance to this author that notwithstanding he commenced his animadversions on the new Constitution, when the delusion was so powerful and extensive as to affect almost a total unanimity of infatuation, and so violent as to make it highly dangerous to doubt of the divinity of this Constitution. When the public mind was reveling in the chimerical prospects of an additional government with a duplicate of officers that was to be administered by the annihilation of all taxes, that was to discharge with the most scrupulous punctuality the principal and interest of the public debts without funds, that was, in short, by some strange magic, to enrich and aggrandize every individual. I say it is very flattering to the Sentinel that although such fascinating visions had rendered the people almost impervious to information, yet his illustration of the impending dangers was so striking and well-founded as to produce so general a conviction of their reality as nearly to give the coup de grace to the projects of ambition, and that, notwithstanding, the author of the Sentinel wrote without concert with or assistance by any other person, not one of the numerous objections made by him against the new Constitution, but what has been recognized and adopted by respectable opposition throughout the United States. And as to the personal attacks made in the course of his essays, he challenges the objects of them or their advocates to disprove the justness or truth of any of the charges or facts adduced by him. So, Sentinel is, I think, heaping praises on himself there to some extent. But going back to that censorship thing, Cal, could a person make an accurate appraisal and say that this government under this Constitution was founded by...
Your NSA guy's blocking you again.
Yeah, I see that happened again, and I really don't know where that's coming from, folks. I totally apologize. But Cal, did you hear my question?
No, just as you went to address it, you went off.
Okay, could we say that this Constitution, which established this government, because they had a 50-year vow of secrecy, could we say that this government was formed on censorship?
Yes, it was. Formed on censorship, conspiracy, criminal conspiracy and fraud, to be exact. But yeah, censorship was a big part of it.
But Cal, as Sentinel just alluded to, we are, you know, Constitution was founded by God, you know, inspired by God, according to the proponents.
That would be part of the mythology.
Mythology.
Mythology is wrapped up in some kind of divinity anyway.
How convenient that we could create a document that would make slaves of us all and say it was God's will.
Really good propaganda. An emotional appeal to the people. I mean, Sentinel's pointing it out that Washington was an emotional appeal. He was a figurehead. I mean, to know the real Washington, he wasn't this great general. He wasn't this great president. He was, you know, in a political body, he was below average. In any, you know, political setting, he was below average of others. He just had a commanding figure, and he was useful, used as a useful idiot to push for the Constitution. Because, you know, the Constitution had the assent of the two rock stars of that day, George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. And that's why the Federalists had them at the convention. It was because they knew they needed to appeal to the emotions of the people.
Okay.
Thing they do today, by the way.
Well, we know that shortly after Washington's death in 1799, there began an effort to deify him into his present position. And that was done by people, of course, who had been members of his political party and others. And, of course, Jefferson was accused of demeaning his godlike characteristics. But let's jump ahead in history. Was not the exact same thing done with Abraham Lincoln?
Oh, yeah, especially if you're assassinated, you become a martyr usually. And, yeah, you end up being deified. And it's part of human nature. It's part of the control. It's part of how the powers that be know how to control the people. They use human nature against them.
Well, have you noticed that JFK was not given that same? I mean, there were people who certainly lauded him for what he had done. But do you see any effort today by the media to turn JFK into a hero?
No. There was, for a while they tried. It was, that member Camelot. That was the Kennedy clan, was Camelot. They tried. It just, for some reason, it didn't stick or wasn't working for their advantage because, Kennedy kind of worked against the powers that be, which is why they had to get rid of him.
Well, if they had have made him into a hero, if they had a monument for him on the banks of the Potomac or a huge monument to him in D.C., do you not think that at some point someone would have begun to say, and look more deeply into how JFK actually opposed the government?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was JFK that said, I wanted to splinter the CIA into a million pieces.
And he fired Allen Dulles.
Yeah. So, which is why the efforts to deify him probably were kind of poo-pooed after a while. At first, they tried and they realized that, wait a minute, the people are going to figure out what's going on a little easier, even though you can explain directly to the people what's going on and they won't believe you now. But yeah, that's why he wasn't. It'll be interesting to see what happens with this new cult that's coming up surrounding the orange Cheeto head guy.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting because nothing has polarized America quite like Donald Trump. It'd be hard pressed to say that, between the splitting of the races, as was very well elucidated by Manning Johnson. You can look throughout our history at the attempt at separation, the attempt at polarization, and the attempt at, concealing the truth from the people. And I think one of the great things is we've talked about Sentinel here. Well, Sentinel's first 24 essays are, you can find what, 1 through 15 or 16 on the internet, Cal? You've probably searched since I have. How many of those can you actually find?
In one place? None of all of them. You got to scratch all over the place to find them.
Well, those first six, of course.
First book of four of them, and that's expensive.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Of course, you can get the book with all 24 essays of Sentinel for the mere sum, paltry sum of $830 at Amazon. Now, that's a very small book. Is that some form of censorship by pricing information so high that the common, ordinary person isn't going to buy it?
Most definitely a form of censorship. Censorship through omission as well. Those are forms of censorship.
Well, Cal, can you think of any other kind of censorship that you witness in everyday life today? Of course, we could begin with the, with the prostitute media. Have you bring up an example of something that you have seen recently that would show a high level of censorship?
Well, the most disturbing part of censorship to me is how people can't engage in an open discussion anymore. You and I, Mike, we have disagreements on things, but we talk our way through it and we discuss it with each other. And even if we don't agree, we still, continue on our discussions and learning, what things mean to us and how the world relates to us individually, to where other people, if they don't like what you hear, they either block you, they shut you off, they turn you in. It's bad enough when the government does it, but when the people at large do it, it's just mass censorship and all it leads to is mass ignorance. And well, mass ignorance is why we're here today in the condition everything is in. And it's the censorship plays a big role like that.
Oh, well, it's been fun. Can you hear me, Cal?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Well, I got blocked out again. I have no idea what you said, my friend.
I have no idea if anybody heard what I said either. Maybe the NSA guy's up, you know, blocking me too now. My NSA guy. They're collaborating with each other, Mike.
Well, is that censorship?
Talk to those two. Yeah, that's censorship. We should just talk to those two guys sitting in that building, in the NSA building in Utah. Hey, dudes. What, are we saying something you don't like? You guys have the ability to get on the radio and talk with us. If you're going to cut us off, come on. Do you know how to cut into this radio? I'm sure you do. Challenging.
Well, guys, here's a question. Is the ability to hide documents from the American public for 50 years, as was done with the JFK assassination, and we're well over 50, and there's still many, many, many documents. Why would this is the point of censorship. Why would the government not want the people to know what happened?
Because, well, didn't George Bush Sr. once say if the American people knew it was happening, they'd hang us all tomorrow morning?
Well, they say he really didn't say that, but I have read both ways. But anyway, regardless of whether he said it or not, it's the truth.
Or would they believe, that's just it. You can tell any more because there's so much misinformation that when you see the truth, you might not even recognize it for the truth anymore. And that's part of the PSYOP that's going on, if I understand PSYOPs correctly. Is that right, Mike?
Well, that would be absolutely correct. But here's the thing, and Americans don't ask any questions. Why would the government that would conceal the truth from you for almost 60 years now. Why would the government conceal that truth from you? To what end? If the government was the bright shining angel in this thing, they would be publishing it from the rooftops. But if the truth was known, what happened with the JFK assassination, would people trust the government that tells them to take a vaccine?
Some would. A lot would, unfortunately.
Well, why do we trust a government that keeps secrets from us anyway?
Hold on, I gotta get my dog here. Somebody walking by.
Okay, Cal's taking care of dog duties there, so we will keep speaking.
The neighbor showed up. I went crazy.
Okay. I understand those dog things. I've got a couple here staring at me now. But anyway, here is the point. I can't understand why people can't see this. Someone who would keep vital stories, vital information from you about the assassination of a president. Someone who would say, even years later, you know, if you will remember, Donald Trump promised he would have those documents made public. Guess what? A government that was totally innocent in the assassination of a president would not hide the details for 50 to 60 years. It just makes no sense. Your thoughts, Cal?
No, I completely agree with that. Anytime the government hides information, it's pretty much guesses for nefarious reasons, and they're hiding the truth. And isn't that what people want, is the truth?
Well, Cal, do you remember the what they call them, the Nixon tapes, back when Nixon was president?
The Watergate tapes?
Yeah, I think, yeah, they called them by different names, but the tapes that were made of the president's phone calls and conversations.
Oh, all the redacted tapes. Yeah, I remember that. Vaguely, I was very young at the time.
Were you ever aware that those tapes are available in the National Archives?
No, I wasn't. Do you have them?
No, I do not. But and I'm not sure you can get copies, but they are, you can listen to them. But here is a point. Did you realize that in that collection of conversations, they also went back and got the conversations of LBJ?
Those would be interesting.
They are quite interesting, especially as to the beginning of the Vietnam War. And it was amazing that people just left this alone, because there were some conversations between LBJ, Sam Rayburn, a congressman from Texas, and Mr. Secretary of Defense McNamara, where they were laughing about the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And basically in that tape, it is proved unequivocally that the Gulf of Tonkin incident never happened. A lie was told to the American public, and we started bombing North Vietnam. Now, why should you trust that government?
You shouldn't. This government hasn't proved itself to be trustworthy.
But we should take its vaccine.
No, I'm not, but yeah, I understand what you're saying. I don't get how people realize the government is corrupt, yet still continue to trust the government, still continue to support the corrupt government. It defies logic to me, and it's got to be an emotional connection to it. It can't be a reasoned or rational one.
Well, Cal, do you remember the movie Robin Williams and Good Morning Vietnam?
Yes.
Remember the two censors?
It's been a lot of years. No, tell me about it.
Well, there were two censors that censored the information that was given out, even on Armed Forces Radio. And during the Iraq War, they brought in journalists, and they were, what they call them, embedded within a unit. They embedded them within units so that what they released could be controlled. And any mess up that the American Army or Marine Corps or anyone else, any mess up that they made in Iraq was censored, and the people couldn't get the truth. What greater barrier can you throw out there and tell people, I can't tell you what happened because it's a matter of national security? Isn't national security our security?
Exactly. It's a blanket cover that's used constantly. These embedded reporters, we didn't know on any of this stuff, and then enter, stage right, Snowden, who exposed this stuff that wasn't, the American people weren't supposed to see.
Well, and stop and think about that. How many people today would still like to see Snowden tried for espionage?
But he didn't commit espionage. He just shared with the American people what was going on.
Yeah, but there were people, I remember back then, I remember a lot of people that I knew, especially military people, were saying, oh, he should be tried and hanged for what he did, because he released government secrets. Well, what if the government secrets that they're keeping are like the JFK assassination, and like the beginning of the war in Vietnam, and the look at the other, and read Operation Northwoods. What are they willing to do People, I'm going to tell you, if you haven't read Operation Northwoods, read it, because the federal government was willing to kill American citizens on the streets of America to accomplish an end, to accomplish a goal. What makes you think for a minute they wouldn't put poison in your arm to accomplish the same goal that they have? What makes you think they wouldn't create a super flu in a laboratory? And then say, oh, gosh, look, now we... And here's my other point. Is it not ironic that we didn't have the Delta variant until we had the vaccine first? Is the Delta variant produced by the vaccine itself? Does it make those who have received the vaccine communicable? Can they transfer this disease, this virus, this whatever it is, to other people through what is known as shedding? And yet we still trust these people? Oh, well, you know, that guy that works for the government, I am going to listen to everything he says because he wouldn't tell me a lie. But now, if we're going to go out here to a doctor that has no government connections that tells us this is all false, well, I can't believe him. He's trying to tell me the truth, or she's trying to tell me the truth, and they're making no money. But I'm going to believe the person who's being paid to lie. Cal, do you have any idea if someday 50, 60, 70 years from now this planet's still spinning and someone writes a history of this era of American history? That's a redundant phrase, pardon me. But someone writes an accounting of American history and includes how just so damn stupid the people in this country were that they would listen to a convicted liar?
But hopefully humanity survives that, and the truth wins out in the end, so that 50 years from now, or however many generations down the road, the truth will actually be known. But yeah, this period of history will be known, I don't know, sort of as another Dark Ages, I would say.
Well,
because the people have just... I mean, you look back on the Dark Ages and the stuff that people believed back going on back then, you know, it was myths and it was stories and it kept the people from being, you know, from advancing. And it almost feels like we're entering into a new Dark Age.
Well, how do you do that, Cal? How do you get a group of people, a society of people, to discard the truth and to attack those who present the truth? How do you do that?
Years of indoctrination and propaganda since childhood. We've had at least, I'm guessing, four generations of it now. So that, you know, the youngest generation amongst us now, they have no idea what you or I grew up with, Mike. No clue, no frame of reference, nothing. You know, and we don't have a clue as, you know, what it was like, you know, a true frame of reference other than our source documents of what it was like to grow up back in the 19th century or the 18th century. You know, I mean, if you go by the history books, yeah, it was all this grand and great stuff. But if you go by the source documents, it tells a whole different picture. And people are missing the full picture. And if you don't see the full picture, how can you make an accurate assessment of your reality?
Okay.
Yeah. I, Cal, I'm sorry. I have so much problem trying to figure this out. But I, you know, in many ways, having once been involved in PSYOPs, and to know how you can get people to respond to emotion, when they would jump out of their seats and jump up and down for emotion, and they wouldn't lift their head for the truth, for factual truth. But you can get people to do almost all kinds of things that they normally wouldn't consider doing if you can use emotion as your guideline.
Exactly. That biggest emotion to use is fear.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's something. We talk about censorship, and I've done this two or three times, and I've gotten so many warnings. Type Joseph Goebbels' name into anywhere on Facebook and watch how fast they shut you down. Why don't they want you to know about Joseph Goebbels?
Because you might figure out they're engaged in exactly what Joseph Goebbels was doing.
Hmm. And they don't want you to use the word Nazi. Why is that? What hurts someone if you say Nazi?
It's been turned into one of those knee-jerk words. I mean, people just have a knee-jerk word, a knee-jerk reaction when they hear the word. Not understanding that Nazi actually stands for National Socialism. And they're only, you know, the only National Socialism anybody ever recognizes was that of, you know, Germany in, you know, during the 30s and 40s, and not realizing that, well, that's what this government is too. It's National Socialism. I mean, what is Social Security if it isn't socialism on a national scale? Would that not qualify as National Socialism?
Well, I think so, but did not, and we use the phrase fascism, but did not, in his early writings and throughout his lifetime, did not Alexander Hamilton propose a fascist form of government?
Oh, yeah. Well, he proposed a monarchical form of government at the convention. But yeah, well, this government already is fascist. What do you think Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 is?
Well, I think that he proposed it when
the economy, you know, to regulate trade, that's to regulate the economy. That means the government's got to be tied in with business somehow or another, and that's fascism. So well, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 is a fascist clause to the U.S. Constitution. There, I put it.
And Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 is a socialist, which, you know, fascism is national socialism. But national socialism and Marxism don't always get along, do they?
No. If the United States had to, you know, Britain had to convince the United States to join in, if it hadn't been for Winston Churchill, it would have ended up being, you know, Adolf Hitler battling with Joseph Stalin eventually, and let, you know, National Socialism battle it out with Democratic Socialism. It would have been a war in Eastern Europe.
Here's the point.
Whole time.
Let me ask you a question, Cal. Is it a possibility that the U.S. was pushed into World War II because fascism in the form of Nazi Germany was attacking Marxism in the form of Stalinist Russia?
Yeah.
Operation Barbarossa. Because yeah. Here was our good friend, the Nazis were going after our good friend and comrade Joseph Stalin. And why did, and our Operation Barbarossa began before the U.S. involvement in World War II. Did we enter that war at Britain's insistence to make sure that Joseph Stalin's Marxism survived?
Yeah, to make sure that fascism is the mercantile system in modern day lingo. It was to make sure mercantilism survived. And to understand mercantilism, you'd have to understand the British East India Company and the British East India Company flag. And then you look at the United States flag and you see the symbols of fascism rolling through history, if you're aware of what to look for. Am I accurate on that, Mike?
Yes. And we have Mr. Hamilton, who stated openly in advocating for the U.S. Bank of the United States, that he wanted that instrument and able to tie the American government to the wealthy aristocracy. Because he said we would get better government by having the merchants, the mercantilists, as you mentioned, involved in the governing of the country. Well, people, we have that in spades today. What is Bill Gates? What is Anthony Fauci? What is Jeff Bezos, Zuckerberg? Who is controlling whom here, Cal?
Well, that big business is controlling government, and government is working with them. How many lobbyists does each congressman said to have? 23, 32?
23.
Like that, 23 lobbyists for every Congress critter there is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those lobbyists, they're... Those are business lobbyists. I mean, where's the... If you don't have money, you can't lobby Congress. I mean, you have to have money to do it. And that leaves us common poor folk out.
Well, take it down to the state level, Cal. I remember 2017 at the Marble Palace in Little Rock, Arkansas. I was there almost every day watching the proceedings from the balcony, watching the proceedings and watching when certain bills would come up. The senators or members of the House would walk out for a break or something. They were immediately surrounded by lobbyists. There was a club in Little Rock, 1896 club or something like that, where the lobbyists and the legislators met for dinner in the evenings and drinks, of course, and various other activities. What makes anyone think that a person as a constituent for any of these people at the state or the federal level, what makes them think that that member of Congress or the state legislature or anywhere else gives a damn about you? You aren't there every day telling them how they should vote, offering them money. And if you read certain books, and I was really enthralled by one, it was called Complicity. I believe it was Complicity. That wasn't the title. I was thinking of another book. But anyway, someone detailed just put out in a book and put it in great detail. I'll come up with the subject here in a minute. But they came up with the fact that Congress will actually propose a bill that they never intend to truly vote on, but they will propose a bill that is quite controversial so they can collect money from both sides of the issue in the form of donations to their campaigns. Have you ever heard that, Cal?
Oh, yeah, they do that all the time. I just got a letter from Ted Cruz asking me for money because he wants to propose an amendment to term limits on Congress. For some reason, he needs money from me. I'm in Arizona. He's in Texas. He needs money from me in order to be able to do that. Okay, whatever, dude. No. No, so... And it is, well, Ted Cruz, you're serving your second term. Why don't you set an example and just not run for a third term? Why not say, I believe in term limits and I'm not going to run again? But no, he's going to use this as a way to make money. And I bet that he rakes in a ton of money from just saying he's going to propose this. And he might propose it, but it isn't going to go anywhere.
And he knows it's not.
Well, he knows it's not. They're not going to limit themselves. They're on the gravy train, people. Yet people will donate money. People will continue to play the game. People will live on opium. They'll be going, yeah, it's a great idea. We need to have term limits. And all these people that keep saying that, how many of them vote for the incumbent? I mean, if you believe in term limits and you vote for the incumbent, you're a hypocrite. Sorry, that's just what you are. If you believe in term limits, don't vote for the incumbent. If you believe in liberty, don't vote. Can I further that up? Or am I going to get censored for that one?
Oh, I was just thinking of something that's hilarious, and that was that there is actually an organization that calls themselves the Organization of Christian Legislators.
Oh, that's scary.
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm saying. Somewhere in time, people are logically going to look down at this and say, oh, yeah, well, this country that has been killing innocent unborn children for decades now has a group of Christian legislators.
The government, you know, to infiltrate and subvert and create whatever group they need to do to drive a narrative, to make money, to keep themselves in power.
You can't make this crap up.
No, you can't, but it's but people keep falling for it.
Yep.
It blows my mind. And like I say, it's got to be an emotional attachment. It can't be through logic and reason. Because logic and reason tells you that this government is criminal. This government is tyrannical. This government does not secure the people's liberty in any way, shape, or form. Yet people still support it. And I'm with you, Mike. I don't get it, other than people have been indoctrinated. They believe that they are free. They stand up and they say their little pledge to about freedom, and they sing their little special song about it. And they got all the permits and licenses to prove it, and they pay their, you know, yearly dues to the government so that they are free. If that's freedom, people, okay. I don't view it as freedom.
Well, you know, freedom, I guess, is what you think it is.
Well, that's just it, Mike. I mean, the younger generations, I mean, you look at the world they're being brought up in, they have even a less of an idea of what freedom is than you and I have. And then each succeeding generation, it just continues to get worse, to where the people are just willing servants. But that was the goal all along, because the best slave is the willing slave.
Yep. So is there a way out of this peacefully, Cal?
Okay, I'm going to lean on hope even and say, yeah, but it's going to take a change in the hearts and minds of the people to seek true justice, to seek true liberty, to search out the truth, to accept the truth when they find it. Other than that, it's going to be violent, or you're going to be cheap. It's one or the other. You know, if people don't change themselves, their hearts and minds, and pursue liberty, it'll be one or the other. You're going to be in total servitude and be a sheep, or you're going to have to violently get yourself out of it.
Well, was John Kennedy, since we've mentioned him several times today, was John Kennedy correct when he said those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable?
It's an accurate statement, yes.
Is there any way to enact peaceful revolution in our country?
Just through knowledge and education. That's the only way. I mean, ignorant people are always going to be governed over.
What if you have a government that is never going to allow the people to be educated?
Then you're going to end up having to either violently overthrow the government, or, you know, start ignoring the government. Don't comply with the government. Break up the government as much, you know, get away from it as best as you can.
Well, the author I was thinking of a minute ago, it popped into my head, was Peter Schweitzer. And he has written several books on the corruption of Congress. I would highly recommend those books. I think they are very enlightening and very eye-opening. But I am amazed at the number of Americans who will buy the book, read the book maybe, and then run out and support a political candidate to put them in the position to become as corrupt as the ones who are there now. Can you imagine electing new members to the mafia?
Well, that's just it, Mike. People keep thinking it's the people in the system, and it's not. It's the system itself that is corrupt. The person with the best intentions can go into the government, but the government's constructed in such a way that in order to do anything, they have to do corrupt things. I don't understand how you can remain an honest person in this government, because it requires corruption in order to operate. It was built on corruption. What else is it going to operate on?
Yeah.
It wasn't built on consent of the people. That can be proven.
Hmm.
Yet people somehow consent today still to it. But that's just because they've been indoctrinated into believing that somehow this is the greatest government ever.
Well,
if it's so great, why is things so bad?
Here is, I'm going to read you a quote, and you tell me whether you find it to be true or not. He said, "Government is an agency of force which can and must be employed against every deviationist. And this is only to say again that the government must oppose the individual. Therefore, the good man in government is like a priest with a machine gun. The mechanism does the harm. The man who operates it merely pulls the trigger."
That's accurate. That's you could use the example of the guillotine. Whoever pulls the rope, you know, off comes the head. Doesn't matter who you put in charge of it, that's what it does. And that's what this system of government is and does. Here it is.
You still there, buddy?
I'm still here. I was just looking for something. If I can find it.
Okay.
Ah, there it is. It says, "Morally and theoretically, the purpose of a constitution is to secure rightful liberty and restrict government. The federal constitution, however, is legally and actually an instrument of implied powers and of tyranny."
Hmm.
The constitution operates off of implied powers.
Well, just to throw something in, we're running out of time here, but here I just read an article that says Delta COVID-19 variant is being shed by vaccinated people, spreads like chicken pox, and the CD document agrees. That might be interesting to read at a later time. But anyway, folks, if you get a chance, check on my Telegram channels, Rebel Madman and Constitutional Fraud, and Sunday afternoon, I have a program at 6 o'clock with my good friend DW, the retired commercial airline pilot, and we will be delving into a like subject on Sunday evening at 6 p.m. So on Revolution Radio Studio A. So I invite you to join in. I invite you to check out those channels. And also my website is rebelmadman.com. Cal, you have some parting words for the folks?
Well, I would just like to further to add, I would encourage anybody, you know, who is seeking the truth and to understand actual American history and not American mythology, to avail themselves of the opportunity to go to your two channels on Telegram, to Rebel Madman or to Constitutional Fraud, because Mike puts stuff up there that comes directly from the source documents. This isn't from the textbook. This isn't from somebody's opinion. This is stuff that actually happened, that the people who were actually there wrote about them actual selves. This isn't, you know, he said, she said stuff. This is the truth. So I would encourage everyone to take advantage of that.
Well, thank you for that, Cal.
And thank you, Mike, for putting all that up there, for putting the truth out there.
All right, buddy. Appreciate it. We've got the music coming on. Thanks for listening, putting up with us here at Dare to Think Out Loud. Have a great week, folks. Talk with you soon.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We talk about decentralization.